Well, welcome to the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting. And this is our second meeting of the session so far. Today, we are meeting to talk about the federal stimulus package and trying to find a way in which we can position ourselves to be ready for what may be coming down the pike in terms of energy and communications infrastructure, probably. Yesterday, we introduced a bill, Senate File 69, which we won't be hearing today, but which could be a vehicle for any projects that may come up as we start discussing how we best take advantage of the federal stimulus package. And I saw something today that said that an energy stimulus package would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 to $35 billion, and then it's been suggested that it might even be higher than that. But all of this, of course, right now is speculation. I think the important thing for us is to know that we want to be ready. We are a state that would like to take advantage of what is available out there in terms of federal dollars. So today we have a guest who is calling in from the National Conference of State Legislatures, Tamara Spielvogel, who is the committee director, and she will tell us what she anticipates in terms of the federal stimulus package. And I think
she should be on.
Tamara?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Spielvogel, I have introduced you. We have a room full of people who are interested in hearing what you have to say. And so I'm going to turn the microphone over to you at this time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad I'm able to provide you with some information regarding the stimulus. My name is Tamara Spielvogel. I work in NCSL's DC office. I cover energy and environment issues at the federal level. And where I want to start with the first slide is to sort of give a background of where NCSL has been to date on
We're just trying to get a better sound system going.
Oh, no problem. I'll wait.
No, is that providing feedback to you? I'm just putting the microphone closer to the speaker here.
No, there's no feedback.
Okay, go ahead then.
The key components of the NCSL stimulus message have revolved around general infrastructure financing, which would cover both transportation and water infrastructure, amongst other pieces of the puzzle, as well as unemployment insurance, food stamps, and a Medicaid match boost. NCSL has been working this issue through activities such as meeting with the transition staff, including the economic team, intergovernmental affairs, as well as different agency review teams on the transition staff. So we've been speaking this message both to members of Congress and the new administration throughout the transition and going back as far as last summer. What we know so far about the stimulus package is very broad strokes. We have seen proposals. We have not seen many details. For example, on January 8th, the president-elect gave a speech concerning what he would like to see in a stimulus package. A number of things in there revolve around energy issues, particularly a green jobs emphasis amongst the 3 million jobs he would like to save or create, a doubling the production of alternative energy, weatherizing 75% of federal buildings, as well as 2 million American homes. And then as part of his infrastructure package, he mentioned the smart grid. Now, the smart grid, it would be efforts targeted at updating the way we get our electricity, but also he noted that we would potentially see financial savings, increased in reliability and preventing power outages or blackouts, and that we'd be able to bring clean alternative energy to onto the grid through efforts to build the smart grid. Now, all of these proposals are very broad strokes. We have not seen details yet from the administration, nor have we seen many details from members of Congress. Right now, we should be on the slide, what else is being discussed? On this slide, you see notes regarding Chairman Jim Oberstar. He is the chair of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, as I'm sure you're aware. Chairman Oberstar is really one of the only members we have seen put out actual written material on what on the package he expects to be dealing with. Mostly, in his case, it is infrastructure. Recent reports have also discussed the energy tax plan. Latest numbers we are hearing are $20 to $25 billion. However, we still do not know what that will cover. Potentially, we're expecting it to cover both alternative energy production and efficiency incentives. We're also likely to see small or large business credits, as well as an extension of certain energy tax credits, including the production tax credit. Now, what's interesting here is the PTC has seen bipartisan support. However, during the last Congress, it faced a protracted debate over whether or not tax credit extensions should be offset. That is what stalled it for most of the 110th Congress. At the end of 2008, it was extended for 1 year. Previously, it had been extended for 2 years at a time. We are hearing that the extension may be longer than that this time, which could provide additional certainty for the industry, but again, we have no details yet. That being said, if we move on to the next slide, I kind of want to go through what all this means once we see details. Now, as I said, these proposals are fairly broad stroke, which means we still could see stimulus funding taking many different forms. For example, it could deal with existing program funding, which could include a state match requirement, or it could include language that would not require a state match. There is also the possibility that this funding could go towards programs that have been authorized but have never seen any funding previously, or they could create entirely new programs. In addition, we could see tax credits or incentives, as I previously discussed, or even loan guarantee programs like we've seen in the Energy Independence and Security Act of 07. We could see a combination of any of or all of the above for any or all of these proposals. Across the board, it could impact infrastructure proposals like smart grid or broadband, but it could also come into play for the energy efficiency and renewable energy projects being discussed as well. Next slide. Now, there's going to be some differences with regards to how the funding is distributed if it goes to an existing program or to a new program. In existing programs, there may be additional rules or requirements that differ from the standard rules for that program. These funds may be classified as use it or lose it funds, where we see a timeline over time requirement for making sure those funds are expended. In addition, there is likely to be additional oversight requirements and potentially reporting requirements that differ from normal for these programs. Excuse me. One final thing I'd like to note is that we may see procedural waivers where these funds are treated as emergency funds, similar to funding that may be released in the time of a natural disaster emergency situation. Potentially, this could impact or streamline ESA or NEPA requirements for certain projects, potentially in the area of infrastructure in particular comes to mind. Next slide. Now, if the funding is directed at new programs, we may face new issues, one of which is that authorized programs which haven't been funded do not necessarily have regulations and procedures set up for the distribution of funds. That may delay that funding, making it from the federal government to the states or the individual programs, depending on what where the funds are directed. Now, this could impact both existing programs that have not had appropriations yet or new programs that are being designed specifically for the stimulus. As I said, because of the fact that we do not know for sure what any of these proposals, what form they will take, it is very hard to predict what procedures and what requirements we are going to be facing when we see the stimulus legislation come through Congress. As late as today, during nomination hearings for Peter Orszag to head OMB, there still was no timeline for when to expect more details on these proposals. Next slide. This slide lists a number of resources, and I'd like to highlight specifically the first one. It is a new website that NCSL staff has compiled where we will be tracking information on the various federal economic stimulus packages and proposals as the details become available. In addition, NCSL is convening starting this Thursday, January 15th, 1 hour conference calls each Thursday to update you on, and by you I mean legislators and legislative staff to be clear, on recent developments as well as provide an opportunity to answer your questions. Additionally, I've provided links to various parts of the President-elect's transition site where we've seen some details or some reference to his proposals, but there are very few numbers attached to those details. It's very much broad stroke proposal outlines or goals, not a lot of details for anyone to be able to really know what's going to come down the pike. And next slide, if we just go to the final page, I've provided information for both contact information for myself and for Neil Austin, my colleague who handles telecom issues, as I know that is also of interest to the committee. In addition, if you submit questions regarding economic stimulus to the email I provided, those questions and answers will be provided to you but also posted onto the economic stimulus website so that as we answer questions from legislators across the country, we can provide those answers to everyone in a centralized location. Madam Chair, that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you or the members of the committee may have.
We're having a bit of a microphone problem right here, Ms. Spielvogel. Your presentation and your slides were very helpful. What we will do is copy those and have them available to the committee members after this committee hearing. At this time, I'd like to ask the committee if there are any questions that you'd like to ask. Senator Alcine, make sure you speak right into the microphone. I'm hoping that Ms. Spielvogel can hear this.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with on the stimulus money, on more of the technology side. In Minnesota, like the 800 megahertz radio system, in the rural parts of the state, it's the cost to install such a system would be prohibitive for county sheriff's departments and fire departments and the backbone for building such a structure. So is there any talk of having that kind of telecommunications or those kind of communications money in the bill?
Just a minute, please.
Did ask my colleague Neil Austin, who handles those issues, if there was any additional information I could pass on. But at this time, there is no clear indication where any of the infrastructure money potentially coming through the proposal on broadband, how that would be dealt with or how it would go out. As I said, we will provide additional materials as we are as we receive them. But I will, if you'd like, I can forward your question on to Neil with regards to this rural capacity question.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Well, I don't see any other questions at this time. Ms. Spielvogel, I really appreciate your willingness to present before our committee. You provided a very helpful overview. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if anyone has any further questions, please feel free to email me or call me.
Okay, thank you. And now we have from Senator Amy Klobuchar's office, the Deputy State Director, Jay Spano.
Thank you very much,
welcome,
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Dahl, members of the committee. I want to thank you all for having me here. Unfortunately, the Senator could not be here as she's actually in Washington working on this right now. And so she asked me to appear here and provide you with a little bit of context for at least her priorities and what she's hearing in Washington right now. As Ms. Spielvogel said, the details are few, the ideas are many, so I apologize that there isn't a lot more detail out there, but it's something that we're working on right now. I also, just in the interests of getting this out there, Will has all of my contact information. I know some of you may have that already, but you're certainly welcome at any time to email our office or call me directly with any questions you may have, and I'll do my best to get you answers as quickly as possible. With that, I'd just like to read a statement from the Senator. Dear Chairwoman Solon, Vice Chair Dahl, and committee members, thank you for inviting me here to join your discussion about the upcoming federal economic recovery package. I'm sorry I can't be with you in person, but I'm in Washington working on this very issue as we speak. I am working with President-elect Obama and my congressional colleagues to put together a national economic recovery plan with the goal of boosting our economy and creating or saving 2.5 million jobs over the next 2 years and creating between 3 and 4 million jobs by the end of 2010. We clearly need to jumpstart our economy in the short term and make investments to build our long-term prosperity. While continuing to work out the specifics, we will likely make direct investments in energy, infrastructure, education, healthcare, as well as provide tax relief to individuals and businesses. The current proposal is to use existing federal formulas to distribute dollars to states and localities who will then turn to ready-to-go projects that can be underway between 90 and 100 days after enactment of this federal legislation. The economic recovery package will also focus on the long term with strategic investments in areas that will strengthen and build our economy through the creation of new jobs. I know that you will be especially interested in the impact of this phase on both energy and high-speed internet development. Transforming the way we produce and consume energy is critical to our future prosperity. The President-elect and I support the creation of a new energy economy that will take advantage of developing technologies and producing new jobs that can't be outsourced, jobs that build the tools to harness homegrown energy, promote greater energy efficiency, and protect our environment through the process. I've seen numerous examples of such ingenuity in Minnesota, and I know that our state is on the forefront of this new energy economy. We will clearly benefit from these investments. 2 weeks ago, I held a roundtable on the need for investment in high-speed internet. I was fortunate to be joined by several state legislators who have been leaders in increasing access to affordable high-speed internet, and I thank the committee chair for her work on this issue as well. I'm working with President-elect Obama on including investments in high-speed internet in the economic recovery plan and gave my first floor speech of 2009 on this same topic. We clearly need to help struggling economies, especially those in rural areas, by expanding the educational, healthcare, and employment opportunities that high-speed internet access brings. The recovery plan is an opportunity to look at the technological infrastructure of this country and to figure out how to strengthen our global competitive edge. Whether you're talking about energy or high-speed internet, this is really the rural electrification of our time. It is the interstate highway system of our time. It is our generation's chance to build for the future in a way that will fit the changing needs of this country and allow us to better compete on the world stage. I thank Chairwoman Brentner-Solon and Vice Chair Dahl and this committee for the opportunity to share my thoughts on our economic recovery plan with you, and I look forward to working with you all to create new jobs and help rebuild Minnesota and America's economy. If you have any questions of me or my office as we move forward on economic recovery and related legislation in Washington, D.C., please do not hesitate to contact Jake Spano in my Minneapolis office. And as I said, I shared with Will my contact information. Sincerely, Amy Klobuchar, United States Senator. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Spano. And thank thank the senator for her comments.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So first we would like to know about where we're standing in terms of energy projects and what the state has been thinking about and how we would position ourselves for any federal stimulus package that would include energy projects. So I'd like to call Janet Streff. And Jeremy DeFebre, do you want to come up together? Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Streff. I'm director of the State Energy Office in the Office of Energy Security in the Department of Commerce. And I'm happy to be here today to tell you what I know, which is very similar to what the others who have gone before me have said. There is nothing specific, however, I think there have been enough information that has allowed us as an energy office to start to look at how we may start to get prepared in the likelihood that we get some funding. I'm vice chair of the National Association of State Energy Officials, and as in that capacity was at a board meeting and had the opportunity to meet with the transition team that was focusing on energy back in December. And they asked questions as far as what kind of projects might be replicable from one state to another. How quickly did we as state energy offices think we could ramp up? What kind of hooks or conditions did we think should be placed to further other things along, and there was nothing concrete that was decided at that meeting, but it was an experience to be part of something in the planning stage at that time. So as I said, there isn't a stimulus bill yet from which to make any decisions, but what I did was, as probably everybody's doing, is going to change.gov and seeing what is that Obama-Biden plan. And from that, I took the components that early on the president-elect has termed important to him that had to do with energy, energy efficiency, renewable energy, green jobs. And so I find that I did not put my name on it anywhere, which I was an oversight at noon today, I think. But it's the components of Obama's stimulus plan affecting energy and green jobs in energy. As I said, this document is available at change.gov. It's the Obama-Biden plan, and I did put in parens the page numbers that these components are in. The actual plan, I believe, is 14 pages long. So the first thing that was there was an immediate action to create good jobs in America. In that, there was $25 billion that he said immediately available to rebuild America's roads, bridges, and repair our schools. And further down then, to make sure that schools could meet their energy costs and undertake key repairs starting this fall. So I would not be surprised to see something in the bill that would meet that. So looking at that, what in Minnesota have we done already? What is our groundwork that we've prepared that will allow us to make use of that funding and put it to use right away? The first thing that we've done that you actually did in 2001 was pass legislation that required us to benchmark all public buildings. And to date, we have done that. Over 80% of all the total public buildings are in the system. since this talks about schools, I wanted you to know that 70% of the school districts actually have one or more buildings in the system. They have all been contacted, but they have not all gone in and verified all of the information. So we have a good base to know which buildings need help the most and where we'd get the best bang for our buck. And then last year, legislation was passed that is allowing us to create the Public Buildings Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program. And that provides technical assistance and financing for cost-effective energy savings improvements. We believe that it can leverage these federal funds to achieve even deeper savings so that by using this program that will already exist, we can go even deeper in the number of energy efficiency improvements than the schools or the cities or counties may have already anticipated. Jeremy handles that program, so if there are further questions, I'll let him talk. But basically, we're currently working with stakeholders on the program development, and we should have a primary contractor selected by spring to start the program. And then operation and maintenance programs, we're finding are key to continuing to keep that energy-efficient building going. So once you've done the energy efficiency improvements, if you don't have a mechanism to check to make sure that it's not going back up, we found that it will. There are a couple of programs that are going on now. One is a private sector program, Schools for Energy Efficiency, that provides low-cost, no-cost measures that use an energy manager in the school district along with those measures to reduce energy use in schools by 10 to 13%, he's found, over multiple years. And this is a program through Hallberg Engineering. We provided some initial funding, but they have been on their own for many years, and it's certainly a successful program and one that would deserve some attention to ramp up throughout the state. Another program that also is working with schools and cities is the Redirect program. Ottertail Power is conducting a SIP pilot right now. And again, it's using the same mechanism. You do the energy efficiency measures, and then you make sure that the operations and maintenance of the building continue. And then we have done some pilot projects on a building operator certification program that, again, trains the operators to do that O&M. The next item, that the immediate relief for struggling families, is an intent to certainly provide funding for additional LIHEAP this year. Certainly today, I think we can all understand that. I've put down the groundwork that we've had so far. John Havanko in our office runs this program, but he does plan to increase the fiscal year 2009 services from $1,200 to a $1,325 benefit, and also increase the number of homes that we should be able to use. In manufacturing and green jobs, there were several there was one program that we are talking about right now with St. Paul Port Authority is proposing a program for industrial energy efficiency. It's a shared savings model that would remove the efficiency improvements from competition for capital. Again, Jeremy's been working on that, so in-depth questions I'll defer to him. But it basically, again, would be a contract with an energy service organization for technical management services. Another component that Biden talked about was investing in a clean energy economy, creating more green jobs. Talked at this point about investing $150 billion over 10 years to advance the next generation of biofuels and fuel infrastructure, accelerate commercialization of plug-in hybrids, promote development of commercial-scale renewable energy, begin transition to a new digital electricity grid, and invest in low-emissions coal plants. What have we done? I would have to say that the work that the legislature has done in the last biennium by funneling several million dollars through our office for grants study and demonstrate these different technologies has been extremely helpful in getting us ready. We've worked with automotive technologies, conversion kits for plug-in hybrids, solar PV thermal rebate program has been extraordinarily successful and is currently sold out at this point. We continue to have the most E85 stations in the United States. And there have been a large number of grants that were given to businesses, entities for renewable energy R&D work. We also have the Twin Cities Solar Initiative, which is a partnership with our office, the U.S. Department of Energy, and Minneapolis and St. Paul. And there is a smart grid docket open at the PUC. I apologize, I don't know the number, and I'm not sure when it closes, but they did open it a month or so ago, so we can certainly get you that information. They talk about creating new job training programs for clean technologies, increasing funds for federal workforce training. So what have we done there? What do we have at least started so that we can build on it? We recently started our revamped residential auditor training program, and the response has been great. We are already working with Dunwoody to ramp up the number of times that it's given and also to work with Minsku and the technical colleges around the state to make sure that not everybody has to come to Minneapolis to take that week-long training. We also are ramping up training for commercial and agriculture auditor training. We've been working with Century College, to some extent Dakota Technical, Canby Technical and Jackson in the past, Fond du Lac. They all have renewable energy programs of some sort, some wind smithing, some focused more on solar. And so it gives us an opportunity to continue to work with them to provide the programs that are needed to train and educate those technical jobs. We're working with DEED right now to make sure that we've got the dislocated worker program tied into all of that training. We plan to accelerate the timeline in our Sustainable 2030 Implementation Plan, which is the University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Research legislation that was passed last year, is requiring us to present a plan to you in July. To tell you and us and the state how are we going to get to net zero energy use buildings, first starting with state buildings is the legislation at this point. And one of the mechanisms is to ensure that there is sufficient training curriculum for architects, engineers, builders, and so on. We certainly have been working with Minnesota Green Star, which is a Builders Association certification program, like LEED for Homes. They are providing training for builders so that they can certify or their homes can be certified. I've had a couple of folks contact me about developing curriculum for a passive house for both new and remodeled buildings, which is a very energy efficient home. Germany, I think, started that procedure. And then one place that we have not in the past been very strong, and one group in Minnesota is the CREED Project. And they have developed energy education for K-12 teachers for many years and have kept plugging along. And this is one area that we know is important. The funding hasn't been there. The curriculum isn't in K-12 probably as much as it should be. So they are also an avenue that could be used. And then finally, to boost the renewable energy sector and create new jobs, certainly I think Minnesota has done a large amount of work in that area already. So what is our groundwork? We'll certainly continue implementation of the renewable energy standard. I think continue the support of community wind development. And then one thing that we are working on right now is we are required to report to you on the possibility of starting a solar certification laboratory. As we've looked into that, we're finding that not only is that a possibility, but it may also make sense to pair it with a testing facility for energy efficiency equipment. Since we need to meet our energy savings goals, we're getting more and more requests. Well, how much does how many energy savings does that motor give? And apparently there's not any testing facility in the United States that is focused just on that. So this, I think, is an opportunity, and we are working on that right now. So those are some of the things that we've seen. There were a couple of other programs that I wanted to highlight that have been authorized and have one has received money for many years, another we're hoping will receive appropriations. If not through the stimulus bill, then certainly through the upcoming federal budget bill. The first one is the Weatherization Assistance Program, which is under my direction. And already the Congress has seen fit to increase that money. I think they're seeing that it is a good thing to actually get those energy measures done in the low-income home and make the home more energy efficient and hopefully reducing the number, the amount of the energy bill. We are doubling the number of dollars that we have received in the state for this next year, and we're hearing that they want 1 million homes a year weatherized. I just heard 2 million in whatever time frame. We heard 1 million homes a year for low-income people for the next decade, and actually that got the whole national weatherization group pretty well mobilized, trying to come up with a plan to see if it was even possible. And actually, they have shown that they could probably ramp up in time to do 1 million homes a year by the end of 2011. So it does take time to get the people trained, the components in place. They also have done some job analyses, many jobs are also of varying technologies are also going to be provided there. And then the last one is the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, and that is a bill that was authorized year before last, I believe, in Congress, authorized at $2 billion. In the last budget right before the end of the session last year, the House had put in $295 million. The rumors that I had heard on this put it at its highest at $6 billion now, so it goes to show how everybody's certainly enlarging their vision. But even if it was appropriated at its full authorization of $2 billion, it would be sending a tremendous amount of money to Minnesota through cities. The formula allows 60% of it to go to the largest counties, 10 largest counties and cities in the state, and then a certain amount to tribal institutions, a certain amount for challenge grants, and then another amount, 28%, would come through our office, with the majority of that going through two other local units of government. It's a conduit that's there that could be used, and so we are hoping that that will come to pass.
Can I interrupt just a minute?
Actually, this I think those are the end of the actual information that I have. Thank you.
This Energy Efficiency and Conservation Grant, is that something where some funds have already been distributed to communities? Or
no, the legislation has been passed and the amount was authorized, but this would be the first year that any money was appropriated.
Okay. And has there been a request for proposals, or is it just automatically being distributed to communities? Maybe Craig Johnson can answer this better.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I am with the League of Minnesota Cities. I only have a little bit of information on this, and Janet can answer anything else that But no, at this time, because there was no appropriation actually made, only an authorization, no one has submitted any, or no one has asked for any proposals because there's no funding to give.
Okay.
There is some requirement in the statute for the cities to initially provide a plan to the U.S. Department of Energy, who then will provide the grants to the major cities and counties. And we would likely do something of the same sort for the money that flowed through our office.
Okay. And Jeremy, do you want to present something too?
Thank you, but no thank you unless you have questions.
You're here just to answer questions. What I'm so aware of is that timing is everything here, and we don't even know what we need to be prepared to respond to, but everything we're also hearing is that the projects that will be funded are those that are shovel-ready so that we can have the greatest economic impact. So I realize that so much of it is speculation at this point, but I'm hoping that you will keep us updated as you're aware of things so that we can be partners together in making sure that we have the greatest impact and that we can take advantage of the most benefits that we can.
Madam Chair. Certainly.
Ms. Streff, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Panel members, on the transportation side, they're talking about maybe doing projects that are design build, you know, because the timeline is so short that there's a lot of projects sitting on the shelf, but the design phase isn't completed yet. So do you know of any projects in this era or area, you know, like buildings or retrofits that could maybe be a design build type concept?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Streff.
Senator Olsen, we have started to meet with the Department of Education, and they have been working with the different associations to connect with school districts to see what schools have projects that are ready to go, whether they're in the design phase or through that. The Department of Administration has been working on state buildings to make sure that they have a list of those projects as well. And I believe Wyslowski from Department of Administration is here. And I think Craig also has been doing that for the league.
Okay. Did you wish to say something, Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Senator, there's a lot of components to this that are being discussed. And in particular, we are looking at some of the needs for, you know, design-build type approaches on the larger, you know, the transportation and water infrastructure projects. We think that there might be some need for the state legislature to look at where that tool can be used to speed up the ability of those projects to get going so that we can qualify for the fast timelines we're expecting to hear are going to be tied to federal funding.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Streff, thank you. I like the presentation that it looks like you've got a broad range of initiatives that we're going to work on, that all of them are important. I wanted to ask a couple of things in regards. First of all, is your office doing anything with, communicating to the incoming administration as far as what the state priorities are? Are they asking for those kind of things, at this point? Because obviously it sounds like from what we've heard up to this point, and there's the broad strokes on what they'd like to do, but it seems to me that maybe they're waiting for some more input from either the state energy officials organizations or the states themselves on what priorities to focus on. Are you getting any of that information?
Ms.
Are you
Streff.
Delivering it?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl. To some extent, I guess I would say that from the work I've done through NASIO and hearing from some of the energy efficiency groups, that what we are trying to do is to make sure that the language is broad enough that the federal guidelines allow us to have the money work within the state to its best use within energy or energy efficiency rather than tying to a specific program. So we've been working more that way.
Okay.
Senator Dahl.
Chair, thank you. The two areas I wanted to just focus on briefly, one was the auditor program. And thank you for allowing me to sit in on that program and observe it. It was very informational and enlightening. And I know we need more of that, and I'm glad to hear that you're going to expand that because, I know a lot of the folks that were there were coming from other parts of the state, and it would be a lot more convenient for them to do something closer to home. And how long is it before you think those things would be up and running?
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we have conducted training in different technical colleges, especially those who have HVAC labs, furnace labs, so we know which ones may be best to actually do auditor training, and have started some conversations, but it's not final, and I don't have a date. I'm sorry.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Ms.
Streff, I think that that's going to be a key component, and I know that if they're saying 1 million homes, weatherizing them, that's probably a big part of why they're saying it's going to take a while to get to this up and running, and the faster we can move on that. I know there's a lot of folks that probably are right on the cusp of being ready to do that, in terms of their pre-qualifications, the industry they might be coming from, just a little bit of training, could be ready to roll on that. And that component, being able to measure what those savings are and target what kind of retrofits are necessary, and whether they're public buildings or in residential settings, are going to be key to maximizing those returns, as well as finding folks that maybe to invest in those kind of programs. One of the things we're looking at right now is finding ways we can get in, say, in the residential sector, how we get dollars into contractors' hands to do those retrofits, especially in the low-income sector where we're subsidizing those homes anyway. They can't afford to do the improvements, and yet without that energy audit, it's nothing to quantify and go back to, say, the bank and say, here's what the savings are going to be. If there's anything that we can do to help accelerate that, I think would be key. The other thing that I was interested in is on the solar and the testing lab. I was under the someone that I talked to recently said maybe that IREEE was not interested in a solar lab, or was I mistaken what I heard there? They are looking at this seriously too.
We have met with IRE and the folks at the University of Minnesota Morris. The folks at Morris are certainly interested in having it at their facility. They already have been requested to do different testing on smaller wind turbines, and so there were different renewable energy components that they had some interest in. We have been looking and talking with the SRCC folks, and to my knowledge, they are still certainly interested in moving along.
Madam Chair, did we do any kind of RFP at this point for someone to start up a laboratory or testing facility over this past year since we put through this last year?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Streff.
Senator Dahl, we did a request for information since there were no funds tied to the statute, and received two proposals. One was from IRE and University of Minnesota Morris, and the other was from the Hunt Utilities Group up in Pine River. Both gave us information on how perhaps we could proceed. Right after that, we've got information that the SRCC folks were interested in broadening the number of labs that they had in the nation. So there are, I think, 9 different states that have expressed some interest, so there might be some competition for that, but we've been getting more information from them and have been adding it to it, so we haven't had a final RFP to have a lab, no.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that, what is the biggest obstacle to getting that off the ground, and if it's funding, is the stimulus package, could that be something that you would think would be qualified under that, the things that we've heard so far?
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl. Certainly, we would look at money from the federal stimulus makes great sense to me to help stabilize that. Part of it, however, I think is we want to make sure that we have the components in place that once they are developed, that they would make the center fully self-sustaining rather than coming back and asking for funding. So we're moving more slowly because we keep getting more information, but it does look positive.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on what Senator Dahl was asking about, the residential retrofits, it sounds like there will be a plan for low-income houses for weatherization, which is going to be a little bit longer than this, what did you say, 190 to 100 days for the immediate shovel-ready stuff. And then sounds like there's going to be stimulus money for public building retrofits. But is there anything that you're aware of for home retrofits for anyone else, for, you know, middle-income residents, anything beyond those two categories? Or do we not know yet?
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, this would get into numbers and programs that the different national efficiency groups would like to see, so I guess it would depend on how successful they are. However, the Alliance to Save Energy, NRDC, Edison Electric Institute, ACEE, have all come together, and I think they all are recommending that whether it's in the stimulus bill, whether there's another energy efficiency bill, whether it's in the budget bill, that there are elements for a home retrofit for commercial public buildings, some sort of industrial program. So they're going through the different places and saying we need to pay some attention to this. So it wouldn't surprise me to see something.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
I know there's a number of us who have been talking about trying to do a broader home energy efficiency retrofit program and trying to make it more widespread. And obviously, we'll hear what Xcel has to, you know, the utility involvement would be an important piece of that. But I'm wondering if we can try to. I mean, Senator Dahl, you asked about the auditors. I'm wondering what all the pieces are that need to be in place, so that if we were to invest in that area or do anything within our means as a state to increase those efforts, if we could be ready for a big infusion of dollars. The LCCMR has put recommended in its package this year a program working with Sheldon Strom and Chris Dufferin, other organizations in Minnesota, to retrofit 6,000 homes around the state, which is a really impressive number, but I would say we could probably do more than that if we were able to match it with other resources. So I really want to try to figure out if we've got everything we need in place to be able to scale that up. And so the auditors is an important piece. Can you answer that question or help us figure out what we would need to answer that question? And we could maybe at another date bring in some of those. I know Sheldon Strom was here, and hear what they have to say about that as well.
Sure. Ms. Streff, do you wish to respond to that at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, there have been many who have been asking the same question, and it comes down to how do we finance this? And it's a question that's not just asked in this state, but
everywhere,
pretty much all other states, I would think. Two states I know that have, three, I guess, that have gone the route of special assessment districts so that it would be a volunteer program for cities. Colorado passed legislation last year that allows that. It's my understanding that Iowa is introducing legislation. I haven't seen that yet. But I have heard from, say, folks, builders through Minnesota Green Star, that how do we bring people to the point where they want to hire builders to do not only energy efficiency, but even go on from there, and how do we provide them with financing that's mm-hmm. pretty easy? And I think that is the question.
Okay. Well, I think, Madam Chair, if I can.
Yeah, Senator Anderson.
Yeah, we'll be talking more about that as the session goes on. Can I just ask one other quick question? Oh, well, and the money that's coming to the cities for energy efficiency, is some of that possibly for residences? The one that's already been authorized?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, it is a block grant, and so I think the cities could, hopefully as years go on, if this is an annual block grant, could make plans to help mm-hmm. Have a program for residences.
Madam Chair, can I ask just one more quick question? You talked about, I mean, the state's done a good job of the B3 audits and getting some information about the energy efficiency improvements that we need to attend to. For schools, there's been some talk over the years about doing an assessment of renewable energy opportunities at public schools around the state. Is that something that's been done, to your knowledge? I'm not sure if we ever passed that requirement or not.
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm not aware of any.
Okay.
I have to say that I share concern. As I said before, timing is of the essence, and it seems to me that, and I realize that there are some financial constraints here, but we should be positioned to respond to, you know, whatever proposal comes forward so that we have those projects ready and to take mm-hmm. advantage when there is money that is available. And so I don't know how we can help you if it would be helpful for us to lay out some policy for how to identify those projects or what would be helpful for you, Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, I heard on the Today Show 2 days ago that it was a day late, that they hadn't quite introduced the stimulus bill, but it does seem as though it's fairly soon that they're going to be coming out with this, and it seems as though it's pretty important to see what kind of guidelines or strings they're putting on it, and then we could jump right on it. So I would hope in the next several days we would be able to really understand what, if any, kind of policies would have to be modified to take the best use of the money.
And I would hope that outreach would be done also to rural communities and less affluent communities so that they can take advantage of this also, those that may not have the staff ready to prepare some of those proposals. Any other questions? Well, Mr. Johnson, you've been sitting there. I don't know if we've gutted your comments or if there's more that you'd like to add.
Madam Chair, I do have a few quick comments I can make that I think will add to some of what's been discussed and give you a little background. Again, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I had one handout that was included with your information that, in my haste, does not have a label or a title on it. It's a two-sided spreadsheet without boxes. You'll see it laid out landscape style. Members have that? Got it? All right. I'll explain what that is as we go. But just very briefly, the League of Minnesota Cities represents the cities of Minnesota. We are the statewide association for cities, and we've been very interested in energy and environmental leadership of cities for a long time. We've been working to assist our cities in figuring out what roles they can play and getting them the tools they need to do that. Last year, for instance, we worked on legislation to improve lease purchase contracts for communities to do energy efficiency improvements to their buildings, to create a renewable energy program for public projects, and to start developing a Green Star Cities Award program for cities who are taking leadership roles and meeting certain criteria. So we were very excited to hear that there are likely to be strong energy efficiency and other energy components as part of the federal economic stimulus package. Of course, there's many other parts to this that our cities are very interested in, the transportation, the telecommunications, and the water infrastructure ones jumping right to the top of that list. So we've been working with our cities, and your request for this information from us, it comes at a pretty fortuitous time, because normally we do not have a list handy of which projects cities think are ready to go. But because we knew that this federal attention is going to be on this, we did a survey that we sent out to every city we have an email address for. 259 cities responded, and from that, we sorted out the projects into the various categories that might receive federal attention. The 21 projects you see here are the ones that fell into energy efficiency types of or renewable energy types of projects. This is by no means all-inclusive of the state. If your community has a project you know of that would fit on this list and you think they're ready to go, have them contact us. We just took what was volunteered. But we are working very hard to get this information. It's been forwarded to every congressional office, and the National League of Cities is consolidating this for every state and putting it forward to the transition team and to the congressional offices as part of our efforts to get information they need on their decisions. And we'll certainly do what we can to give you that information. Things I would add to what was already said are that this is just a very important time for this kind of work, and we really do have cities that are ready to move. We know that there are timelines that are going to have to be met. We know that there are a lot of opportunities out there, and we are going to be looking at places where this can create jobs. The economic stimulus is a very key part of this. It's a wonderful byproduct that we're going to be saving a lot of energy costs for local governments at a time when budgets are very tight. But the other benefits of this are pretty significant in what it can do for building green jobs and ongoing benefits for our communities in areas, you know, I think most of our communities are fighting very hard to establish their leadership in and actually are competing with each other to see who can get the best green jobs available. So last thing I would say, just as a reminder, is if you are aware of projects, please do have your communities contact us. We'll be glad to get this included. This is by no means, you know, this isn't an application list that's the only projects that are being considered anywhere or anything. This is an informal survey done by the League of Minnesota Cities. So we'd be happy to add other projects to this if they are in this category. And I'm happy to answer any questions I can about other efforts we're making.
Senator Gerdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, thank you. And I was curious, in the procedures that you're taking in identifying these projects, do you need to work up through the state, or are you to do the application sort of when the money comes through, or through your understanding anyway? Is that going to go through the state down to the cities, or is it a direct feed to the what's the mechanisms that you, as you understand them?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, the mechanisms, as I understand them, for the block grant funding are, as Ms. Streff explained, the 60% of the funding would go directly from the federal government to the 10 largest cities and counties in the state. The rest of the money has other percentages that go to various places, tribes and other sources. I think it's 28% goes to the department, and the majority of that goes through them out to smaller communities who would have to qualify through the department to get that money. They'd essentially do their planning through at the state level.
Okay.
The larger communities would get their money direct from the federal level. The National League of Cities is encouraging some relaxing of some of those restrictions to get the money straight out faster. Just allow cities to directly get the money from the federal government. Maybe make it more extensive than just the top 10, you know, in the state, and actually allow more cities and counties to get the money directly. We know if they set the qualifications for the projects, cities can be ready to meet those and do the projects. We don't really need a lot of administrative oversight to have three different agencies at the federal and state level check off and make sure that was done. So okay. We're encouraging that the money come directly to the cities as much as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I'd also like to thank Ms. Streff and Mr. DeFebri. And Rick Evans now from XL Energy to talk about Smart Grid. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy Government Affairs. I'm a bit of a last-minute fill-in for this hearing, and I apologize for that. If you get me too deep into Smart Grid, I'll get lost. So I'm going to do my best, and if there are questions I can't answer, I'll be happy to find those answers for you.
Well, this seems like a really fascinating project and probably something that we'd like to have somebody come in and probably tell us more about it some future date. But if you could just give us an overview.
We'd be very happy to do that, Madam Chair. Smart Grid is a fully interconnected system, starting at the transmission system and going all the way down to individual homes in a very sophisticated and comprehensive way. It would allow a couple of different things. On the utility side of the meter, it allows us to get real-time data on outages, on where the faults are located, and on how the restoration efforts are going. So in terms of reliability for customers, the smart grid gives us a much better opportunity than we have now with the current grid to identify and quickly respond to problems and even anticipate problems because of the real-time information being communicated back. I should start this by saying that smart grid is not only an upgrading and a changing of the electrical components, but it's also a sophisticated communications. And the communications is really the key to the smart grid because it allows both the utility and the customer to react to real-time information to accomplish these things that I'm talking about. The other thing that the smart grid does on the utility side of the meter is give us real-time information on power consumption. This way we can really understand in a much more in-depth way how our customers are using their energy, when they're using it, and how much. And it allows us to work with renewable energy like wind and solar that can be intermittent to manage that in a more efficient way and get better use of it because we will know so much more about what our customers are doing. On the customer side of the meter, which is where I think a lot of us will find this really, really interesting, is it gives the customers real-time feedback on price, on the type of energy that's being used, and on what their personal usage is. It also, through the software, allows them to accommodate their use of energy in an automated way with the information that they're getting. So, for example, a customer could set their system to make sure that they're getting the lowest cost energy, that they're using energy at the lowest cost time. They could set their system so that they're getting low carbon energy. They want to maximize their use of the wind energy and the solar energy and other low carbon alternatives. And the system, when it's fully set up, will allow them to set that. What that does then is allow them to communicate their smart appliances, for example, to communicate with the grid. Their dryers know when low-carbon energy is available. Their dryers know when the lowest-price energy is available. And customers can set themselves up so they're essentially restricted from using the energy until those components are available that they're looking for. And at the same time, the customers can actually see, you know, physically how much energy they're using, and they can change the settings for their homes in accordance with the information, the feedback that they're getting. Another part of this is for plug-in hybrid vehicles. I think there's been some discussion in this committee about the fact that plug-in hybrid vehicles not only pull energy out of your house to charge their batteries, but those batteries can also be used to put energy back in. And with the smart grid, as the use of energy by the homeowner becomes more known and can be understood, then the energy that's going into and coming out of your car, essentially the two-way charging and discharging of your car, will allow you to manage your energy, again, along the profile that you've set for yourself in your home. The handouts that we provided, as they indicate, we have started building the smart grid city in Boulder, Colorado, which is part of our service territory out in Colorado. And I'd invite you to read that, and if you have questions or want further information, we'd be happy to provide that. But it goes into a little more detail than I'm able to about how this all works. One of the handouts, I think, has to do with the chancellor's residence. The University of Colorado is located in Boulder, and the chancellor's residence is really the first one that has been fitted out with the smart appliances, with a plug-in hybrid vehicle, charging and discharging, and the computer technology that allows the residents there to know how they're using their energy and what kind of energy they want to use. Finally, I think we provided you with a copy of the federal law that describes the federal policy on smart grid. This is not a money bill. This is just a bill describing policy. It was not necessary for us to do the Boulder project, but it describes the kinds of things that we're trying to learn in the Boulder Project. The Boulder Project is a, you know, very much a research and development tool. Solar energy, we know less about than wind energy, but still we're learning about wind energy, the use of batteries, the use of plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, and some of these other the profiles that our customers want to set up for their homes are all things that we're learning about in this process. And when the Smart Grid City in Boulder is fully implemented, we'll be learning, we hope and expect, a great deal about how to manage the energy in a more efficient, cleaner, lower cost way, and in a way that our customers can adapt to their own particular lifestyles and tastes and preferences.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And so you're saying that that homes could be programmed to take advantage of renewable energy or lower cost energy, or
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the customer would be able to set the parameters that they're looking for, the kinds of things that they're interested in. If you were really interested in making sure that you were using electricity at a time when the maximum amount of wind or solar energy was available, you can set that so that, now what that means is some of your appliances aren't going to work until those conditions arise, but then you'll know that, and you'll know and it allows you then to structure your lifestyle to take advantage of those things.
Questions? Senator Rommel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is fascinating. Can you, it seems to me I read the report as quickly as possible, it seems that one of the advantages is that it will allow for distributed energy.
Mr. Evans.
It makes that, for example, distributive solar, that solar can be located closer to where it's being used.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is part of gaining the knowledge of, really the real-time detailed knowledge of the customer's use of energy. If you put a solar panel on the top of your house, for example, there's two things that you could do with that energy. You could sell it back to us as a generator, just like a coal plant or just like anyone else who has a generating facility. The other thing you can do is you can use that energy yourself to offset your energy bill. There are advantages and disadvantages to doing it both ways, and learning how that works and how it works with your lifestyle and with the individual homes is an important part of this.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, is this pilot project, does that include feedback or feed in and inverters and that sort of thing, or is it just for purchased energy? And is, for instance, if you're generating energy, is it a net metering, or can you do a feed in?
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Evans.
Member of the committee, who let the engineer on the committee? I don't know the answer to that, Senator, but I will get that for you. Yeah.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had two questions. The first one is on, and I don't know if you can answer this one either, I'm wondering if there's going to be an overlap with the need to have information with all this. Are we going to, with our expansion of broadband and the wireless technology, are you going to be overlapping some of these technologies, and are you going to be partnering with the different industries to achieve that goal of getting that information, or are you going to develop a completely new system for the smart grid?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the best answer I can give you is if you look on the back page of this, while we like to take a lot of credit for Smart Grid, we're part of a consortium, a group of partners. I don't know the role of each of these companies, but you'll see there's six companies named at the bottom of the back page. All of these companies, including Xcel Energy, are devoting research and development money to this. So we're not reinventing the wheel for Xcel Energy. We're taking advantage of some of this knowledge that's already out there, particularly in terms of the communication and the software, the hardware for the computers.
Okay. Madam Chair, but thank you. As far as the infrastructure, though, that'll be kind of an independent system then, as opposed to, cable services, any other telecommunications, or you're not going to tie into that, as far as you know?
Mr.
Evans? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure the answer to that question, but I'll find out.
Okay. Madam Chair, my second question is, when we looked at the first presenter, they talked about the Obama packages would include smart grid as part of the stimulus package. Are you working, or do you know that working with that administration, the incoming administration, to talk about what you're doing here and how we can tie in? And are you working with the Office of Energy Security on this as well?
Mr. Evans?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the answer to the first part of your question is yes, but this is a Boulder, Colorado project. So, you know, but XL Energy and our lobbyists in Washington and the other people associated with this project are definitely looking at potential money out of the stimulus package and talking with people out there about that. Here in Minnesota, we are not as far along on this kind of a project. We are looking at some projects. I'm hoping in the next couple of weeks we'll be able to talk in a little more detail about some projects we would do here in Minnesota. And we are, as we're developing those and thinking about those, we're thinking about sources of money, including the federal stimulus.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Brittner Solden. I wondered if I could ask Senator Carlson a question.
Sir. It's up to Senator Carlson.
You asked a question that I wondered if you'd be able to explain to me what the information, if you had been able to receive it, would explain to you. What was it that information would tell you, if you knew the answer to that question?
Senator Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, if you're, you know, there's the notion of feed-in tariff, where the price that you sell back to the utility is higher than the price that you buy from them. That's commonly used in Europe. We use net metering, which is your meter can run backwards, but it just deletes from your bill at your meter rate. Well, if you do have feed-in, which is what I think someone was talking here about, I think Mr. Evans was talking about it, where you can actually use the capacity of a plug-in car battery to feed back into the grid, mm-hmm. You'd have to, one, be able to change that to the type of power that's used in the grid, which is alternating current, and also you'd have to somehow meter it, and it wouldn't be worthwhile if you would just have net metering. So you'd want to be able to sell back in at a higher rate than you bought and charged up your car battery. And that's what would be the incentive for you to have an extra capacity battery in your car, is that you'd be able to bring it into your automobile battery and then feed it back to shave the peak, at peak demand.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Evans. At this time, we'll move on into telecommunications projects, and the first speaker is Diane Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the opportunity to provide comments today. My name is Diane Wells, and I'm a manager in the Telecommunications Division at the Department of Commerce. Before I address this specific topic before the committee today, I thought it might be helpful to briefly discuss broadband in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, can she pull the mic closer?
Sorry.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Is this better?
Much better.
Okay. First of all, broadband is a high-speed method for connecting to the Internet. Currently, the FCC defines broadband as data transmission speeds faster than 200 kilobits per second in at least one direction. And by the way, that's a very low definition. A lot of people would like that definition for speed to be increased. For telephone company DSL service and cable modem service, the lowest speed offered is most likely to be in the range of 1 to 2 megabits per second. We are even seeing some applications up to 20 megabits per second for DSL and 40 megabits per second for cable modems. The more megabits per second that your connection can transmit at, the faster you can send or receive files, pictures, videos, etc. So faster is better, and where available, the higher speeds have a higher monthly cost. Now, who provides broadband in Minnesota? Landline telephone companies offer DSL, which is digital subscriber line service, and a few companies also offer broadband directly over fiber all the way to the home. Cable companies offer cable modems. Wireless broadband is available from wireless companies. We also have some more local or niche type companies that are offering fixed wireless broadband. We have some municipalities that are offering broadband. And it's my understanding that we did have some broadband over power line or BPL in Minnesota. I'm not sure we still have any going on today. Now, thanks to legislation that was passed last session, there is a broadband mapping project underway in Minnesota, and preliminary maps should be available in February. That project will tell us where geographically we have no broadband available, where there is one provider offering broadband, or where there are multiple providers. The information will also tell us the speed of that broadband at a county level. In addition to the mapping project, the Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force was also created by legislation last session. That group, made up of a cross-section of providers and users, has been meeting since July and will be submitting a report by November 1st addressing such issues such as the connection speed that is reasonably needed by all citizens by 2015, a description of policies and actions necessary to achieve that goal, how the public and private sectors can cooperate, an evaluation of the security, vulnerability, and redundancy actions necessary to assure reliability, the costs to reach the goal, a description of the economic development opportunities made possible by the wide dissemination of broadband, and an evaluation of how broadband can benefit education, health care, community-based organization, and government. And Rick King, the chair of that task force, is the next person on the agenda. Finally, I wanted to discuss the regulatory context of broadband. The FCC has determined that broadband is an information service, not a telecommunications service, so we do not regulate broadband at the state level. That means the companies that provide broadband make independent business decisions on where they place broadband, the speed that they offer, and the monthly rates that they charge. So, unlike electricity and telephone service, where the deployment of these utilities from the 1930s through the 1950s under the REA is cited to as an example of how government can work to ensure availability, there the government also had in place a regulatory structure to oversee the end user rates that were charged. Also, because we don't regulate broadband, we don't know who all of the providers are in Minnesota, and we'll get a pretty good idea from the broadband mapping project, so we should have that in early February. Now, turning to the issue of broadband being included in President-elect Obama's economic stimulus package, we have not seen many details. In his speech last Thursday, President-elect Obama said, "To build an economy that can lead this future, we will begin to rebuild America." He then mentioned roads, bridges, schools, a smart electric grid, and with regard to broadband, he said, "It means expanding broadband lines across America so that a small business in a rural town can connect and compete with their counterparts anywhere in the world." We've heard that the stimulus package could take the form of tax credits, it could be accelerated depreciation, it could be direct grants. If it is direct grants, the question is, what aspect would the grants address? Would it be for infrastructure directly to the providers to install to customers that don't have service or to underserved areas? Or would the grants be more grassroots to communities that have demonstrated public-private cooperation? There could also be a program to stimulate broadband usage. Right now, we have about 75% of the households in Minnesota with a working computer, and approximately 58% of those households statewide subscribe to broadband. And these figures are from the Center for Rural Policy and Development survey that was conducted in late 2007 and early 2008. So while you can strive for 100% broadband deployment, if only 75% of households have a computer, 25% of that investment would go unused. Right now, the Department of Commerce is actively monitoring what might be in the stimulus plan, but a lot is unknown. If it is a tax credit, that would be handled in tax filings. If it is a grant program, both DEED and Commerce have experience in administering grants. DEED has done technology catalyst grants in the past, and the Department of Commerce has its energy grant programs, but the telecom side also has some experience with issuing grants related to distributing Quest penalty money in past years. If it is a more grassroots type of effort, that has been done in Minnesota. The Blandin Foundation has provided community grants for education and stimulating usage of broadband, so that is a model that is out there. Connected Nation, the company that is conducting the mapping project here, has done county-level teams to stimulate broadband usage in some of the other states where they've also done mapping. And the Alabama Advisory Committee overseeing their broadband initiative just hired a company called CostQuest Associates to identify gaps in broadband mapping and to increase broadband usage in areas that lack it. Now, to demonstrate the uncertainty regarding what we may be called upon to respond to, I'd like to describe four from several filings that have been made with the Obama transition team with suggestions on how to include broadband in the stimulus package. OPASCO, which stands for the Organization for the Promotion and Advancement of Small Telephone Companies and whose membership includes the nation's smallest telephone companies, is recommending that the stimulus package include build-out grants to rural telephone companies so that they can expand their networks to accommodate 25 megabit per second service. To receive the grants, a telephone company would have to install fiber and appropriate network equipment and be a Federal Universal Service Fund, or USF, high-cost program recipient. And under OPASCO's proposal, the grants would funnel through the federal USF. The Communications Workers of America, or CWA, is recommending that the stimulus package include funding for S-1492, which is the Broadband Data Improvement Act, which was passed last year by Congress but didn't have any funding attached, along with requiring studies of broadband speed and price in the United States and abroad. The law requires the Secretary of Commerce to award grants with a 20% matching requirement for the development and implementation of statewide initiatives to identify and track the availability and adoption of broadband services within each state, and would include funding for programs to improve computer ownership and internet access in unserved and underserved areas. The CWA is also advocating for accelerated depreciation for broadband infrastructure buildouts and a broadband investment tax credit. For rural broadband, the CWA is supportive of direct grants and public-private partnership tax credit bonds. The CWA believes that stimulus funding should also be used to increase computer access and how to use the internet through grants to community-based organizations and libraries, and microloans to low-income households to purchase a computer and to receive free broadband access while the household is paying off the loan for the computer. Like the CWA, the NARUC, or National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, is recommending that the Obama stimulus package include full funding of the Broadband Data Improvement Act. NARUC further recommends that any federal stimulus money for broadband deployment programs be funneled through the states, that unserved and underserved areas be targeted and money not be used to fund a competitive broadband network, that any investment be to achieve next-generation broadband speeds, that support go to the most efficient and economical technology that provides the necessary speed, and that any federal program be of a specified duration and only use money specifically appropriated via the stimulus package and or matching or contributed state funds. Finally, Quest, the largest local incumbent telephone provider in Minnesota, has a proposal which would include direct grants be made to individual states to fund broadband deployment of unserved rural areas. The states would distribute the funds through an RFP process run by a state office of economic development, which would have 60 days to review and grant or deny an application. The private industry would have the right of first refusal to deploy broadband to the target areas. Under Quest's proposal, only if private industry did not pursue the opportunity should a government option be explored for the broadband deployment. In conclusion, we are monitoring the situation and will continue to do so. We don't know at this time what, if any, role the Department of Commerce might have, but we can certainly stay in close communications with committee staff as more is known on what might be in the Obama stimulus package regarding broadband. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Wells. I wanted to touch on one thing you said towards the end there about expansion of the service to, say, I think, libraries and lower-income folks and things, doing some of that. With the telephone service now, we have this, Federal Universal Service Fund, and can Can we have a maybe the Department of Commerce lobby the federal government to change some of those, the direction of that funding, to go towards subsidizing the investment into broadband instead of the deployment of wireless technology? I think that service has been in place for about 10 or 12 years. Seems to me we've reached just about every place we can with wireless, and that broadband seems to be a better place to apply that, those dollars instead of seeking new money. I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, the whole Federal Universal Service Fund is under review. The FCC, with the new appointments, will most likely be looking at that, and there's been a lot of discussion how to handle the money in the fund, because it is, first of all, the funding mechanism is fairly broken. It's a percentage of interstate revenues, and it funds high-cost areas. It funds the Lifeline program. It funds the E-rate program, and then there's a rural health care funding component, and there is discussion underway about whether or how to use that money for broadband. And there's also discussion about how to contain what's been kind of a fairly upward growth in the amount of dollars that the wireless carriers are drawing from that fund. And that's one of the reasons in some of these stimulus package proposals, there's discussion about not funding a competitive provider, because in some of the rural areas, it just may not make a business sense to have two or three providers out there trying to compete with a fairly low number of customers. So it's all under consideration, and there have been numerous comments filed with the FCC on how to restructure.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you, Ms. Wells.
Thank you.
Rick King?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. Pleasure to be here to talk to you. I'm Rick King. I'm here as the chairman of the Minnesota's Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force, which was established legislation last year. I'm happy to report that Governor's Office appointed a very diverse group with lots of different opinions and positions across the state. So I do think that we'll have a very comprehensive report for you as of November 2009 as prescribed, but we have a lot of information that we've already obtained, and our group is extremely interested in what's going on with the administration and the interest in accelerating what can be done with broadband. So we stand ready to assist, to help look at different activities that could be done that we've already uncovered, as well as and helping in any way that we can this group and any other groups that are going to be disseminating such things. We do cover all areas of the state. We cover almost all the disciplines, healthcare, education, cities, small towns, counties, businesses, citizens, and so forth. So you have a diverse statewide group that, as I said, covers all the compass positions on these topics. As we understand the Obama administration plan, there's really two things that we're looking at, and we've been told that the immediate shovel-ready projects as they pertain to broadband will probably be few. The funding will probably go to other areas in the infrastructure in the early stage. Following that, though, there's a second phase of projects, and those seem to be predicted to be 30 to 60 days out, where broad funding for broadband will be expected in that wave. So I think the assumption by the administration is there aren't as many broadband projects that are shovel-ready as compared to perhaps roads, bridges, and those types of things, and other areas where you can get right to work. Not sure that's totally true, but in essence, I think that may color the way people are looking at this in two waves. So I think that we need to be properly prepared, particularly for that second wave that will occur shortly thereafter. Senator Klobuchar, and her understanding of this in the December meeting that was alluded to already and in the floor speech, I think reiterated this. So I think we have it on pretty good authority. Also, I believe the statistics are there that the work on broadband definitely is positive for the economy, for job growth and so forth. So it fits the criteria that everybody is looking for. I think this committee is very smart to look at broadband opportunities for the economic growth and connectivity in the state, and our group stands ready to help jump on things as funding are available, and we stay very actively engaged with this. I'd like to then talk a little bit about where the areas of potential help might be. And I want to make a strong note here. We have people in our task force who would say that if the government could fund all of this, it should be done. And we have other people in the task force who say the government shouldn't fund one penny. And then we have a whole lot of people in between. So we have a diverse group of opinions, and as I try to represent the total opinion, I think I must first say that to you. What is clear to me, though, is that our entire group would suggest that we look very carefully at the funding to make sure that we don't disincent any existing things that are going on in this area. Particularly in rural Minnesota, there are many activities by small providers who are actively engaged in meeting the needs of local customers, and they're investing their own money to build things up. One of the worst things that we could possibly do in trying to do good would be to create a competitor for one of those companies that then has to compete with some funding from the federal government and actually disincents them from spending the money that they can do in their own business case. So we just need to be very cautious about how we apply that. And when I hear the questions about the Universal Service Fund, I of course think of that too. That in this particularly unregulated part, broadband that is, we've got to be very careful about what we do and how we do it going forward. One of the things that's come up very strongly is that not all areas of Minnesota are covered well for broadband under almost any definition of speed. And as Ms. Wells said, the speed as currently dictated by the FCC is not what we would refer to as broadband speeds. It's very slow. But there are places in Minnesota that don't even have that speed, and whether it be by wire or by wireless or by cell coverage. So I think coverage is one of the key areas that we should look at in terms of whatever kinds of stimulus are provided. I think funding for demonstration projects or pilot projects, particularly as I think about things that might be in the healthcare area that help our seniors and people in remote areas and bring medical capabilities and specialties to places that don't have it resident, would be a very important area to give consideration to. I think we need to look at seeding private-public partnerships. I think that's a very important angle here. I think if we can get municipalities and counties together with some of the providers and perhaps provide some incentives in that area for cooperation and agreements, we may see things pick up and even go beyond the actual funding themselves. And then one part that you want to probably think about in our task forces too is there are places in our state where there is no redundancy. And this would be very important for a business such as mine. I work for a company called Thomson Reuters, where I'm the COO of that company. And one of the things we found out is that almost all of the internet connections in the state that people use go through one particular facility in the state. So that one facility, should it go down or should it be taken down by any kind of means, makes our state vulnerable to being cut off the internet, except for those companies like mine that pay tons of money to have redundant paths that go through different locations. Almost all our internet service goes through an office in Minneapolis and then on to Chicago. So we almost have, in that essence, one path. So the notion of redundancy is probably really important for the infrastructure of the state from an electronic point of view. And I think that it's easy to get paths that go south to Kansas City or other locations, but those are not the ones that are typically used by the public. As for funding methods, we would probably support things that include outright grants, for matching grants, loan guarantees, perhaps low-interest loans, tax incentives, and other forms of funding that go there, whatever happens to be relevant, but always keeping in mind that we don't want to disincent the already going investments that are being made in the private sector. And as I kind of wrap up here, I'll commend our website if you're interested in more information there. Our staff are. The doings of the Broadband Task Force are at ultra-high-speed-mn.org. And all of the materials are there, and it's all our meetings are published and open. And I'd be happy to include anybody on the committee, Madam Chairman, on the list to get that information pushed to them rather than having someone have to go out and pull. And committee staff can certainly, has been in contact with me and can certainly take the names, and we'd be happy to add folks. Finally, I would just say that the broadband infrastructure is part of a very important infrastructure that we hear a lot of conversation about. When I spoke with Chairman Oberstar, we talk about roads and bridges investments in airports and seaports and bike paths and sidewalks and the like. And I think as we talk about those, each of those, we need to also toss in the electronic infrastructure or broadband, because it is actually the overflow of some of those infrastructure points, like the roadways and the airways, that are causing us to have to overbuild for peaks, when we could use other forms of the of our infrastructure to deliver some of the things that are commonly gone through the air or through the road. For example, a business model of old called Netflix sends DVDs around the world. They come out of a warehouse, they go into a truck, they go into a plane, they go into a truck, they go to your house, and then they reverse the path to go home. And Netflix is currently working on an electronic delivery of the same service, so a person in their home can order that video without all that carbon footprint that I've just described, without using the roads, without using the air services, without using all of that energy. So I think that if we think about the infrastructure in total, we could consider a rebalancing of it, trying to send the right things down the right path in the right piece of the infrastructure, perhaps could offload some of the demand on the roads, on the bridges, and so forth, and perhaps the electronic infrastructure can take some of that load off. So we look forward to working closely with the chair, with the committee, and I'll stand for any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Are there questions? Are you feeling hopeful about the work of the Broadband Task Force?
Task Force, I think, has made a lot of progress so far. We continue to have good discussions, and we've heard from a lot of the constituencies, the provider constituency, and we've gotten a lot of detail from them. We have education up on our next meeting, which is this Friday, and we're actually doing our first meeting statewide via teleconference. So that's going to be a good thing. And we'll be taking our committee meetings on the road in the spring, so we'll be going to Greater Minnesota to try to facilitate more involvement from the public. We've got a lot of input. We've started to write the beginning pieces of our report, and we're very hopeful to have some very concrete recommendations about the policy goals, the timing, how we might fund it, and so forth, well in time for our deadline. But we also, at the same time, are concerned to make sure we give you what you need, because this opportunity for the stimulus has come up since the creating legislation for the task force. So we are quite prepared to take on other duties that you all might think we should.
So you're anticipating you can give us a preliminary report in February, is that correct? And then we can anticipate your report and full report in time for the next session in 2010.
Madam Chair, we will do our best to get you our status in February so that we can make that more action-oriented, so that these kind of monies that are flowing through, you'll have our best estimates on that. We haven't heard from all of the groups yet, but we will give you an interim look at where we are.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. King.
Thank you.
Next speaker is Steve Milkey, City Administrator from Lakeville. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. I also realize, being the final speaker, it's incumbent upon me to be quick. I have basically 3 points to make today, and I was asked by the League of Cities to come and comment a little bit on some of the things that cities are doing to prepare for and to be ready for ultra-speed broadband. Hopefully I don't restate many of the things that Mr. King stated, because without comparing notes, some of his comments are very similar to what I have. My first point is that there is a growing recognition of the need for ultra-high-speed broadband capabilities in Minnesota. There are a number of communities, Lakeville being one, but I know other communities in Dakota County as well, that have had ongoing dialogues with their business communities. And as such, they have learned that the business communities are nervous about the infrastructure that exists. They're nervous about the future of the infrastructure because it does not have many of the things that Mr. King mentioned. While those companies that can afford it can get high-speed access, but they can't necessarily get it at reasonable costs. For redundancy, the multiple pathways, I know in Lakeville we had a situation where a cable connection was cut and about a third of the community for a day was without high-speed internet. The businesses that were affected by that, the individuals in their homes that were affected by that, reported significant losses in terms of their income. So they need redundant methods, more than just one, in order to have capabilities on the internet. They need greater choices, multiple providers. Without competition, cost becomes an issue. And in Lakeville's case, and I know others, we are looking to potentially build our own network for our buildings so as to be able to save money in the provision of our services. Examples in Lakeville, we have a software company that's attempting to expand. They currently are on a high point in the city, therefore they have the ability with microwave technology to connect to a building in downtown Minneapolis. That provides them with some level of comfort. But as they are looking at locations to expand, they're looking for other high points because there is not ultra-high speed capabilities available to them in most of the town. We have a cold storage business in town which has one access option. Their complete system of inventory control and shipping is controlled through that one access point. They've told us that they lose sleep at night trying to understand how they would survive if they were to lose that one connection that exists. We also found out that in Lakeville, and I'm sure in others, there are about 35% of our homes at some point do business either by telecommuting or home-based businesses. They, too, if they want to compete on an international basis, need to have higher speeds, higher capacities than what they currently have. And because they're small businesses, they can't afford the cost to get ultra-high speed to them. Therefore, the first point is there is a need for ultra-high speed broadband beyond that which is available from current technologies. Point number two is there's a number of local governments across the state of Minnesota that are ready, willing, and able to put fiber projects in the ground if financial resources were available to assist them. But there are significant costs associated with building fiber infrastructure. There are a number of cities and other government organizations that are preparing to build fiber networks. The League of Cities did prepare an 11x17 page that has just a sampling of some of the cities that are working on various projects. And that is not an all-encompassing list, but it is just a very quick survey and things that people wrote back on. For these cities to proceed, however, debt financing is a significant hurdle for them to get over, and as well as incumbent provider resistance. And concerns like these are causing governments to have difficulty and nervousness in getting projects going. My final point, then, would be that local governments in the state of Minnesota need to work together to provide the infrastructure the business sector has stated it needs. It's been shown and proven that the United States is not globally competitive when it comes to ultra-high-speed capabilities. We rank very low and behind very small countries in terms of our ability to compete and provide infrastructure that's going to be needed and is needed today. We think that a regional or statewide fiber network would set Minnesota in a strong position for high-tech business development. Mr. King mentioned that there is today one hub or one central hub for internet connections in the state of Minnesota. Since the September 11th attacks in New York, where they had one connection point, they have now got six redundant points because when they lost their connection, they lost redundancy, they lost the ability. In Minnesota, we have one building as well where most of these connections come. We think that the state of Minnesota should pursue a second hub, at least, for the state of Minnesota. And depending on where that's located, it would provide for an immediate increase in capacities as well. We also think it would be preferable to direct resources to collaborative groups rather than individual cities. That way the network and those things that are being attempted can be at a larger basis, and that the state in handing out these decisions should leverage resources by requiring local match. Projects that get attention are those where it's totally grant funded. There is no skin in the game, if you will, by the local government, and those tend to fail. And we would recommend that whatever grants or programs are put in place, make sure there is a local match component. I'm not an expert in this area, I'm not a technical expert, but I can tell you that the work that we've done with our business community has made it abundantly clear to us that they're looking for higher speeds at a reasonable cost and doing so in such a way that if it goes down, there's other resources available to them. And we think the multiple sources that exist today are inadequate, but a fiber network on top can provide additional redundancy. Thank you.
Mr. Mielke, I'm not sure that I understood your comments, but I want to check this out. It seems to me that you were advocating for more than one provider in an area for higher competition to drive down costs. And Mr. King was suggesting that, Mr. King was suggesting that one provider in an area was sufficient.
We did something called, in Lakeville, it was the Business Telecommunications and Task Force, and the businesses in our community said that they want choices. They want multiple choices so that there is price competition in the marketplace. As long as there is only one provider, one place to go, whether it's government or private sector, the level of competition and therefore the price will be dictated rather than letting the free market handle it.
Okay, I don't know if Mr. King wants to say anything.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did not intend to imply one provider in one area is sufficient.
Okay.
Simply that one has to be careful if one incents a provider via funding to come into an area where an existing provider is already spending their own dollars and to not create imbalanced competition in that area. I would suggest that, generally speaking, more competition in the area is going to give you better options, and that would be something I would subscribe to. But my point was about the funding
unfair subsidy.
Unbalancing sure. thing, a condition, an unintentional consequence.
Okay. Any questions, Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mielke, I agree. I think we need more competition there. And my thought is, especially when you're talking about needing financing for some of these, get these projects started, taking this concept of we've got a information superhighway, if we as a transportation system that that there shouldn't be individual ownership of the highway, you know, that we maybe the cities and municipalities own the road and then lease out the road to those companies that want to provide the service on it. That way, you know, we don't have to dig up the road, you know, or the streets every day to lay new fiber for each individual company that needs to come in or get this huge capital investment. You do it one time, and then you lease out or do a contract for access to that line to provide the service. That way you could have multiple providers, you know, in those areas and provide that competition. Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Mielke?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl. What you're describing is what I understand to be called an open access network. It would be similar to an interstate highway system where, in that case, the government established and built the interstate system, but multiple users, all of us, can truck down the highway as we wish to and help pay for that highway in some fashion. Mm-hmm. An open access network is something that some cities are considering. There are other cities that are looking at a closed access and therefore becoming a single provider rather than multiple provider. I can tell you in our case, the work that our business community came up with, they are very interested in having an open access network. And one other similar kind of an analogy is that if you were to think of a fiber network similar to a water system, I would suggest to you that our business community has told us that we currently have a 4-inch pipe where we need at least a 12-inch pipe. And we need to expand the capacity of those pipes as the need and the capabilities grow.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a big difference in if you're going to have, let's say you're going to allow construction originally and you would say that maybe we decided down the road that we wanted everyone to have open access? Is there a difference in how that is installed originally if that were to take place?
Mr. Mielke.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not a technical person. My answer to you, however, would be that fiber, as long as it is a big enough pipe, is not going to be the issue. It would be the electronics that go on either end of that pipe as to how you secure and allow multiple providers to access. But it certainly is technically feasible to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Mielke.
Thank you very much.
Is there any discussion by committee members at this time about what we've heard regarding positioning ourselves for the stimulus package, whether in energy or communications? Well, Senator Dahl.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'm hoping that that since we've got such a wide range of options, it seems from the federal government coming down, it seems like they've covered all of the bases of potential ways of fashioning the package. And it seems to me there'll probably be a lot of open-endedness to the whole thing when it finally hits the streets. And I'm hoping that we as a state are able to, you know, be prepared no matter what comes down. And, I mean, it probably is going to be from our committee to decide which areas that we think that the state needs to focus on, and hopefully we've got an open communication with the Office of Energy Security so that we can partner up on our the directions that we're going, so we don't miss something or duplicate efforts where we don't need to.
Right, but so that we are prepared when it comes time to respond to the proposals. Okay. Anybody else? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to take too much of the mic today, but
that's okay.
I'm hoping. One time we took a visit to the Thomson Reuters facility, and thank you very much for that visit. It's a great facility, and you have an awesome operation there. It's very impressive. Now I understand that you're thinking about possibly at some point expanding out. So I want to encourage you to think about those windmills on that campus, you know, as an alternative energy source, and to be that showcase for the state on how individual companies, if they have the ability to take on some of those energy needs themselves. So, but thanks for being here. I know that with the amount of folks that work at your operation, how they can have you here for half the day is pretty impressive. You must have some good managers there. So,
yeah. Okay. Other comments or questions? Well, then this will be the end of our meeting. The next meeting will be on January 22nd, and at that time we'll deal with, the whole meeting will be on the low-carbon fuel standard. January 22nd, that's a week from Thursday. So meeting adjourned.